The headlines: Iran asks the IAEA Board of Governors to vote down an anti-Tehran resolution submitted by the U.S. and its three European allies. NATO says it is not inclined to give Russia any guarantees on the deployment of nuclear weapons on the territories of its new potential members. And the U.S. Treasury Secretary says the country is facing, quote, unacceptable levels of inflation, and the consumer price index is likely to remain high. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Iran is asking the Board of Governors of the International Atomic Energy Agency to vote down an anti-Tehran resolution submitted by the U.S. and its three European allies, Britain, Germany, and France. The draft resolution will be put to vote at this week's meeting of the 35-member policy-making body of the IAEA. The draft reportedly calls for an Iran to fully cooperate with the agency to clarify and resolve outstanding safeguard issues. It also accuses Iran of having undeclared nuclear materials at some of its sites. As the Board of Governors convened on Monday, IAEA Chief Rafael Grossi also said in a press briefing that Iran's cooperation with the agency has been insufficient and inadequate. Iranian officials immediately rejected the claim, saying that the country has fully cooperated with the UN nuclear watchdog.
Sampling at a couple of sites showed a very little amount of nuclear particles. Subsequently, Iran offered the required and sufficient explanations to the IAEA. Constant pressures by the U.S., some Western countries, and the Israeli regime are among the reasons why the IAEA has put the issue as a major point on its agenda. The agency has no independent role.
The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran also echoed Gharibabadi's remarks. Mohammad Islami said Iran has provided the IAEA with adequate explanations, but the agency does not have a serious will to call Tehran's responses convincing. He criticized the IAEA for relying on Israeli reports. He also warned against political infiltration into the agency. Tehran says any anti-Iran resolution at the IAEA would negatively impact both its cooperation with the agency and the JCPOA revival talks. The Islamic Republic has pledged to give a proportionate response to any such move. NATO says it will not offer Russia any guarantees that it will not store nuclear weapons on the territories of its two potential new members, Finland and Sweden. In an interview, the Military Alliance's Deputy Secretary General said that it is up to the individual countries whether they want to host nuclear weapons, noting that NATO will not set up some principal restrictions on the matter. Finland and Sweden have applied for membership in the U.S.-led military bloc. The Nordic states say they made the decision after Russia attacked Ukraine. Their bids have so far been challenged by Turkey, which accuses them of supporting terrorist groups. Russia and Ukrainian forces are locked in an intense battle in the eastern Ukraine region as the war between the two neighbors grinds through its fourth month. Moscow says its troops are now in full control of residential areas in the city of Severodonetsk.
The residential areas of the city of Severodonetsk have been fully liberated. We continue to establish control over the city's industrial zone and the nearest settlements.
Fierce fighting is raging on in the streets of Severodonetsk, with the city mayor saying that the situation is changing every hour. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says his forces are outnumbered by more powerful Russian troops, but they still have a chance to fight back. He also said Ukraine will continue the fight until it takes back all of its territory from Russian forces, and that stalemate is not an option. Zelensky rejected speculations that Ukraine might cede some parts of its territory to Russia to end the war. The U.S. Treasury Secretary says her country is facing an unacceptable level of inflation. Janet Yellen says the inflation rate is likely to remain high for a while. She, however, expressed hope that the price hikes would slow down soon. Yellen was speaking at a Senate Finance Committee hearing where she dismissed claims by the Republicans that President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID-19 spending package was to blame for the rampant inflation. The U.S. Consumer Price Index currently stands at over 8%. It is the highest in the past 40 years. In an effort to rein in inflation, the Federal Reserve is increasing the interest rates. The U.K. is facing a cost of living crisis that has exacerbated already stifling desperately and austerity. Now people are mobilizing to demand the government bail out to the poor, not the rich. Bianca Rahimi tells us more.
The UK has marked the Queen's Platinum Jubilee. The royal family paraded the capital over the long bank holiday weekend, and Transport for London finally opened the long-awaited Elizabeth line. But strikes put a damper on things, with members of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, desperate for better pay, walked off the job. Rose works for TfL. After a long day on the picket line, she spoke at the People's Assembly. The cost of living crisis has hit hard, but who will bear the brunt?
This is affecting all working people of all different types in all parts of the country. And that means that we do have to come together. We do need to recognise that we are in this fight together.
The government must act. It must act to make sure that children aren't hungry. It must act to make sure that people don't lose their homes. It must act so that people can go on holiday. That's an important thing as well. And we're going to lose all of that across the next few months unless the government changes course.
The speakers insisted the key to success was unity. Massive rallies are being planned, and people from a myriad of causes will be attending.
We're in a situation now where in the most serious cost of living crisis, the most serious attack on working people that there's been for generations, our government is considering increasing what is already a massive defence budget, a massive arms spending budget. And that seems to us to be completely absurd and actually disgraceful.
The speakers here today warned that dire poverty is knocking on the doors of millions of people across the UK, and the government has no intention of intervening. Record price hikes have already happened, and more is just around the corner.
Food, fuel, energy bills, mortgage premiums, national insurance contributions and tuition fees. You name it, the price has gone up. Politicians are blaming the UK's predicament on external factors.
But Mr. Speaker, the war's most significant impact domestically is on the cost of living. COVID and global factors meant goods and energy prices were already high. Statistics published this morning show that inflation in February was 6.2%.
But during the same period, energy companies have reported record profits. City bonuses have gone up six times wages, and politicians have made it to the UK's rich list. Households have been promised a few hundred pounds in relief, but it won't even scratch the surface, as millions of families wonder where their next meal is coming from. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Hospitals across France are deeply impacted by a strike from medical personnel. French public health used to be ranked the best in the world, but austerity measures have caused a sharp decrease in the quality of care. Ramin Mazahari has more.
With unions showing rare unity, hospitals were brought to a near halt across France due to a major strike. Since the Great Recession began, seemingly no group in France, other than the Yellow Vests, have protested more often than medical workers.
France's healthcare system was ranked number one in the world as recently as the year 2000 by the United Nations. However, its quality has plummeted following over a decade of banker bailouts and austerity cuts.
Neoliberal economics as applied to public health care has created too many complaints by medical workers to list. Frozen salaries, slashed budgets, overwork, closed hospitals, a lack of equipment, gutted morale, and much more.
Thousands of medical workers who refused orders to get coronavirus vaccines haven't been reintegrated, even though corona restrictions have ended in France. And that has created even more labor problems.
When you don't replace workers who retire or quit, then you're going to have longer wait times for critical medical care and worsened medical care overall. It's just gotten harder and harder to work at a hospital every year. We now have so few personnel that it feels like every single day is a strike day.
The degraded service has been dramatic and a common topic across France for years. The healthcare system is used by everybody, so politicians haven't been able to limit the negative impact to just the lower classes.
After 5 years of Macron, our healthcare system is in a state of catastrophe. We're seeing more and more people die from a lack of treatment. We have the money inside France already. Just tax the rich and businesses. Go after tax evasion and stop focusing public policy on the richest 20% of society. If we do that, then we'll have good public services and good health care.
The first round of legislative elections are less than a week away. The strike is a black eye for President Emmanuel Macron, just as he's trying to preserve his absolute majority in Parliament, which is crucial for him to be able to force through more neoliberal austerity measures. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
A UN-mandated independent inquiry commission has concluded that Israel has no intention of ending its occupation of Palestinian lands. The commission was set up by the UN Human Rights Council after the 2021 Gaza War to find root causes of the decades-old conflict. In its report, a high-level team of investigators said that the ending of the occupation of Palestinian land by Israel remains essential to ending violence. The report cites evidence showing that the regime has no intention of doing so, and instead pursuing a complete control over occupied territories, including East al-Quds. Israel has slammed the report, as when cited, the 11-day Israeli war on Gaza last year left some 250 Palestinians dead. The report will be discussed at the Geneva-based UN rights body next week. Meanwhile, Gazans have marked the 55th anniversary of Naksa Day, which saw the complete occupation of Al-Quds and the rest of Palestine. Al-Quds was occupied during the 1967 Six-Day War when Israeli forces occupied the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, as well as the Syrian Golan Heights and Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. Ashraf Shannon reports.
Palestinians protested in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the 55th anniversary of Naksa Day, meaning the Day of Setback. Naksa Day refers to the defeat of Arab armies in the 1967 war, which saw Israel's complete occupation of Palestine and Al-Quds, as well as the displacement and dispossession of more Palestinians. In recent weeks, extremist Jewish settlers backed by Israeli forces have been violating the sanctity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. During a press conference, Palestinian resistance factions vowed to continue on their path of resistance against the Israeli occupation.
The criminal Zionist enemy must understand that the Palestinian people will always protect Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Palestinian people will sacrifice their lives for the sake of Al-Quds. Aggression against Al-Aqsa and Al-Quds will only happen over the dead bodies of Palestinians.
Naksa Day came just 19 days after Nakba Day of 1948, which saw the forceful displacement and dispossession of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians upon the creation of the Israeli regime. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas warned the Israeli regime against violations in Al-Quds.
As we mark the 55th anniversary of the Zionist aggression of 1967, we assert that we will continue to fight for the sake of liberating Al-Quds, the eternal capital of Palestine. There is no such thing as Zionist sovereignty over Al-Quds or over Palestine. Al-Quds, Al-Aqsa, and Palestine belong to the Palestinian people.
Decades on, Palestinians have been trying to liberate their occupied lands by all forms of resistance.
As they mark the 55th anniversary of Naksa Day, Palestinians in Gaza say they will continue to resist the Israeli occupation until the liberation of their land. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
white supremacists are no longer causing trouble exclusively inside the United States. American authorities are now concerned about the battle-hardened extremists fighting in Ukraine who are set to return to their homeland. And that is particularly worrying amid the rising violent incidents inside the U.S.
U.S. authorities are questioning Americans flying to and coming back from Ukraine. Documents reviewed by Politico show that the U.S. government is gathering information about Americans who are planning to leave the U.S. for Ukraine and are tracking their activities after they return. That only backs up reports that American ultranationalists and white supremacists are moving to Ukraine to join the fight against Russia, alongside those Russia brands as, quote, neo-Nazis.
This is the model that we've seen play out time and time again, going back to Libya and Afghanistan and Iraq and certainly Syria and other places. And, of course, we'll see it play out again, because ultimately, in my opinion, what's happening in the Ukraine was made to happen inevitably by U.S. policy. And it's, in effect, another example of a proxy war, in this instance, between the U.S. and Russia.
But it appears that the political optics of the matter is of a secondary concern to U.S. authorities, who see the country's national security at a greater risk. Documents obtained from the U.S. Customs and Border Protection mention six unnamed Ukraine-bound Americans questioned at the airport who were either war veterans or had had military training. Two of the six were carrying military equipment. At least three had links to far-right groups. Amid the recent rise in gun violence and mass shootings in the U.S., the country would see deadlier attacks if the perpetrators have the experience of being in an actual war zone.
The exact number of American nationals fighting in Ukraine is unknown, but a report in March estimated it to be around 3,000. The challenge that they pose to Washington is twofold. First, they will return to the U.S. with more military training, which could escalate the country's already alarming rate of domestic terror incidents. And second, they confirm the notion that Moscow is fighting a war against neo-Nazis and foreign elements.
And now, with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program.
If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's advice on political groups, particularly the parties affiliated to the West and the East, urging them to give up enmity against the Islamic system and joining the nation. This time, we are going to touch upon his advice to writers and speakers who unfairly used to weaken the Islamic Republic and the strenuous efforts of the nation. Stay tuned, please. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, used to advise writers, speakers, and so-called intellectuals who would try to divert the course of the Islamic Republic toward the big powers and trivialize the goals achieved by the nation, especially martyrs and their selfless families. He writes in his testament, "My advice to writers, speakers, intellectuals, and those who forge false is that, instead of spending your time against the course of the Islamic Republic and doing your best in suspicion, ill wish, and ill speaking towards the parliament, government, and other servants to lead the country to the superpowers, have your lonely moments with your God for one night, and if you don't believe in God, have lonely moments with your conscience and examine your inward motive to see by which criterion and furnace you ignore the blood of these youths in the fronts and cities. You have staged nervous war against the nation who want to get rid of the yoke of oppressors and external and internal looters, and selflessly preserve the independence and freedom which they have achieved by sacrificing their lives and the lives of their dear ones. You are fomenting sedition and treacherous conspiracies and open the way for the arrogant and oppressors. Is it not better if you would guide the government and the parliament and the nation with your thoughts, pen, and speech for safeguarding the country? Would it not worth for you to help this oppressed and deprived nation and to assist to stabilize the Islamic establishment?" Imam Khomeini, elsewhere in his testament, addressing the writers and speakers, says, "Do you consider this parliament, president, government, and the judiciary worse than what was there during the former regime? Have you forgotten the oppressions that damned regime used to enforce against this oppressed nation? Don't you know that the Islamic country was a military base for America and it used to be behaved like a colony and the parliament, the government, and the military forces were in their control? And what their advisors, industrialists, and specialists would do to this nation and their reserves? Has it escaped your memory, the promotion of indecency all over the country and the centers of corruption, including the brothels, gambling houses, bars, cinemas, and other centers, each of which was a great factor to corrupt the young generation? Have you forgotten the totally corruption-inducing mass media and magazines and the newspapers of that regime? The founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran castigated the March 3, 1981 events in which then-President Abu'l-Hassan Bani Sadr had deceived a handful of gullible elements and naive youth to change the course of the Islamic Revolution toward the West by murdering innocent people and revolutionary students in Tehran University. The Imam said, "Do you link and shake brotherly hands with those who explicitly condemn Islam and have staged armed rebellion against it or have embarked on rebellion with pen and tongue, which is more regrettable than armed uprising? And do you call those whom God has described as worthy of being killed as apple of eyes and sit beside the players who created the disaster of March 3rd and beat innocent youth to death and watched the event? Is this an Islamic and ethical act? And has the practice of the government and the judiciary, which have duly punished the opponents, deviant and heathens, caused you to shout in defense of the innocent? I regret for you brothers, whose past record I know to some extent, and I am interested in some of you, but not for those who were wicked ones in the guise of benevolence and were wolves in the garb of shepherd, and players who had ridiculed everyone and were hell-bent on corrupting the country and the nation, and were serving one of the looting poles, those who wickedly martyred the valuable youth and men and ulama training the society, and had no mercy on innocent Muslim children. These people have scandalized themselves in the society and before the all-dominant God, and have no way to return as the Satan of the soul, prompting to evil, is ruling them." Imam Khomeini writes elsewhere in his testament as he addresses writers and speakers, "You faithful brothers, why don't you help the government and parliament which are trying to serve the deprived and oppressed, and you are just complaining? Have you compared the skill of service of the government and foundations of the Islamic Republic with the hardships and disorders which are natural for every revolution? And have you compared the imposed war with so much damage and millions of foreign and domestic homeless and excessive sabotages during this short period with construction activities of the former regime? Don't you know that the construction activities of that time were limited nearly to cities, and that to the wealthy neighborhoods, and the poor and deprived people enjoyed little and nothing of those things, while the current government and the Islamic foundations are serving this deprived stratum wholeheartedly? You, the faithful, support the government so that the affairs are fulfilled soon, so that you may go to the Lord's presence, which you will go willy-nilly with the badge of serving his servants."
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. His
really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems, questions, and issues parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their offspring. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. We have in studio today our speaker, Sister Razia Batul Najafi. She's an Islamic researcher, and I have had this pleasure to sit with her in the studio today. Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much for having me here.
Thank you so much.
Can I ask you, how are you?
Alhamdulillah.
I know you're looking perfect, mashallah.
Thank you so much. I am looking perfect because you're in front of me.
Alhamdulillah.
Today, I would want to start with an audience question, which is, what is the best age to make a child sleep in another room who has been sleeping in between his parents since his birth? And in case a child is growing up and is not ready to sleep in a separate room, is there any tip or idea to make him feel he should sleep in another room? Well, that's a very challenging question.
Yeah. As we have discussed before too, in chapter Nur, Allah Tabaraka wa Ta'ala is mentioning about the age of maybe approximately after 6-7. We call it mumayyiz. Mumayyiz in Islamic term means the child who now has this recognition of male and female a bit, like in a very, very
who's
child.
Who's able to differentiate between good and bad.
Yeah, good and bad. Yeah. And a bit he or she knows that, yeah, this is boy, this is girl. And, you know, girls and boys, they are different. So look at, the sensitivity of Islam. I love it. The qawaneen, the ahkam, rules, and the rulings for mumayyiz. Mumayyiz from tamiz.
All right.
Yeah, tamiz. Means the one who can differentiate between, you know, male and females, a bit needs, and, you know, the differences between them, very little, but still, look at the still Islam is sensitive, still, you know, so we need so much emphasis to talk about this most, you know, sensitive topic, according to Quranic teaching, because yes, Quran is sensitive, we have to be sensitive too.
Exactly.
So yeah, therefore, after six, after seven, seven-ish, six-ish, you know, we have to be very careful about our dressing. You know, you can't believe it in Islam. In me, for example, if I'm having a guest, for example, yeah, and for example, your child, your son is somehow
some 6 years
six,
old.
Yeah. So your son is coming, so I cannot wear the very comfortable dress. Yeah,
right.
The way I dress up in front of ladies, I have to keep eye on Mumayya's child. I say, oh, Zainab's son is here.
Right.
He is plus six, so I have to wear something modest,
not
complete hijab, but something modest.
You
know,
modest,
yeah, covering my head. You know, having full sleeve. So this kind of teaching Islam is,
providing us.
Yeah.
So you're trying to say, if a child is visiting your home who is six plus, or even if you have a child at home who is around six or seven,
you need to take care of your dressing. You need to be a little modest. If not, you're not doing a very proper Islamic hijab, but at least you need to have a modest dressing so that you cannot be like a center of attraction for that child.
Absolutely.
Sister, I'll be talking to you. We need to take a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. We're talking about the question that audiences have made. First of all, before you answer this question, I would want to ask you, is there any concept like you need to definitely make your child sleep with you since he's born?
Yeah, Islamically, I think after 2 years, because within that 2 years, you have to give...
You have to feed your child. Yeah. Right.
So because of breastfeeding, Islam is not that much emphasizing to make him or her
about
sleep.
About your own personal life. Yeah.
So you can have something, you know, some cot nearby your bed. Yeah.
All right.
It's not necessary that the child...
You put your child in between.
Exactly.
All right.
So the child would be in the same room, but, you know,
maybe in some
next
separate
to,
bed. Yeah,
separate bed. So that would be the best thing. And then after 6-7, yeah, we recommend, like, Islam, according to Islamic teaching, so it would be more recommended to separate the bed and definitely
room.
The room.
Obviously.
Yeah. So, and even we have a hadith and sayings of Masumin alayhi salam that, you know, the brothers and sisters, they're not allowed to share the same quilt and same, we can say blankets.
All right.
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, they're just little. Like maybe they're just, you know, 5, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old and they're having one quilt and they're sleeping together. So it's better to have a separate quilt. Maybe two small children, they are sleeping in one big double bed. They can sleep, but they should have their own quilts or whatever.
Separate blankets.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, separate blankets.
So even if they are siblings, you need to separate them. They cannot sleep in one blanket.
Even siblings, you know, brother, sisters, you know, look the sensitivity, you know.
Especially in the environment we are living in.
Yeah, this is Islam. And one more hadith says, like, if a young girl, for example, maybe again 6-7 years old girl, yeah, if she comes and sit on the lap of non-mahram, yeah, any like cousin or uncle who's not mahram, not
a mahram uncle,
yeah,
all right,
so it's not allowed to make her sit on non-mahram's lap,
all right,
or to kiss her cheeks. So these kind of small, very in detail, we have sayings of Masumin alayhi salam, which shows that
sensitivity
beautiful education which Islam is teaching us,
all right.
And that means a lot because nowadays we can observe, because now, especially nowadays, we understand more the value of these amazing teachings of Islam.
Yeah. Yes, undoubtedly. So the beautiful point you said over here was that it's not mandatory to make your baby sleep in between you and your partner. Yes, a mother has to feed her baby, obviously, but she can separate the bedding though in the same room so that she can also breastfeed the child and also, like, not to let the child sleep in between her and her partner. Sister, I'll be talking to you on that note, but here we need to take a very, very short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
Ya muqdiy al-khayrat, ya muqdiy al-khayrat.
The 24th surah of the Holy Quran, Surah An-Nur, the first part of verse 58. O you who have faith, let your permission be sought by your slaves and those of you who have not reached puberty 3 times.
before the dawn prayer, and when you put off your garments at noon, and after the night prayer.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. Sister, we discussed a lot of points and you answered so many beautiful questions by audiences. Now, you also said what is the age, like when a child needs to be separated from the parents' room. There's one more challenging question we had. The question was that if a child is now 6 or 7 years, what you called as mumayyiz, the one who is able to differentiate between the good and bad, and who is able to differentiate between male and female, who is able to differentiate between different sexes, how do we separate that child from our room who is not kind of, getting ready to get separated?
I think step by step, because after maybe 5 years, 6 years, in one jump, maybe your child cannot accept this big change, in big jump. So what I have seen in my friends' circle, that sometimes they say every, for example, Monday and Thursday, twice a week, you're allowed to sleep just for 1 hour with us. Then Mama Baba will take you to your room. Or maybe once in a week you can sleep with us. You know, that would be like a treat. And or maybe before, when he used to or she used to sleep with us, we would not maybe pay attention that much towards him or her. But now you say, if you sleep in your bed, you know, we promise that we are going to give you this gift. For example, we'll keep something under your pillow
and
you sleep.
Fulfill your promises.
Definitely. Yeah. Small things. Like whatever he likes, you know, right. Like maybe, I don't know, whatever is healthy,
so
something to eat.
So you encourage your child by different tips.
Yeah. And telling them nice stories before going to bed more, mm-hmm. you know. So I think that steps will help, because I also have 8 years old child. So alhamdulillah, we are successful to make him
throw him out of
sleep.
The room.
No doubt. But just like that, you know, like, wow, you're my hero. Look at my Hussein. And definitely we bought a new quilt and, you know, set off his
bed. Brain bedding.
So maybe somehow after 2-3 years, you know, we have to make refresh their bedroom and a big huge teddy bear according to his request. So he sleeps with his teddy bear, and definitely he has his brothers too in his room, and then he's okay. But it was difficult, definitely, at first when we started to work this.
Well, they say that if there are no pains, there are no gains. So, So you have to make some expenditure. All right. Thank you, sister, for being with us. It was a really nice session with you. Thank you for answering so beautifully from the narrations from the Noble Quran. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. For any suggestions, for any questions, for any feedback, please email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can find us on social media platforms by searching Call of Islam Radio. Our website is parstoday.com, wherein you can find all our programs. Going to the option Call of Islam and you'll find our programs. Until another episode, fi amanullah. God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all by the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is
It's a complete way.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson will launch last-ditch attempts in coming days to win over critics in Tory ranks with health and housing policy announcements. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written jointly by Jessica Elgott, Peter Walker, and Aubrey Algerati under the heading Johnson prepares fight back as allies admit confidence vote now likely. Please stay with us to hear more about the details. Boris Johnson's allies will switch their focus to winning a vote of no confidence after conceding that they now have little chance of stopping one being triggered. The Prime Minister will this week launch a health and housing policy fight back in a last-ditch attempt to win over his critics. He is widely expected to face a vote on his leadership as soon as this week, and with some MPs predicting that the threshold of 54 letters asking for one has already been exceeded. In a remarkable shift in tone, the business minister, Paul Scully, acknowledged on Sunday, June 5th, that a vote of no confidence might well happen, but insisted Johnson would face it down. Whatever happens, we've got to get back to governing, to tackle the things that people want us to do on a day-to-day basis. Hours earlier, the Transport Secretary, Grant Shapps, had said he had not thought that there would be a vote this week. Number 10 source said Johnson would demonstrate over the coming days that he was getting on with the job and acknowledged it was also aimed at showing his determination not to be fatally weakened by a confidence vote, which the prime minister expects to win narrowly. The source said there was no prospect of Johnson offering his resignation if he won by only a small margin or of offering to go before the next election as Theresa May did. Aides said Johnson will not shy away from the potential humiliation of the two upcoming by-elections and is planning visits to Wakefield and Tiverton, both of which the Tories are widely expected to lose to Labour and the Liberal Democrats respectively. Some newer MPs are said to be nervous of acting too soon and are considering pushing to delay a confidence vote until after June 23rd, when the by-elections are due to be held to give the best chance of ousting Johnson and allow potential leadership candidates more time to prepare. Amid accusations from some of Johnson's supporters of number 10 complacency, the Prime Minister will focus on the NHS backlog, heralding the progress the government is making to tackle waiting lists. In a nod to the use of cash raised by tax increases that are unpopular in sections of the party, Johnson will announce in the coming day that 1 million checks and tests have been carried out since the rollout of the new community diagnostic centers, freeing up hospital capacity. He explicitly linked it to the national insurance rise, dubbed the health and social care levy, much criticized by Tory MPs, and said the funding would mean the NHS could tackle the COVID backlogs, reduce waiting lists, and save lives. Later in Health Week, a major review of NHS management by the former Vice Chief of the Defence Staff, General Sir Gordon Messenger, will propose an overhaul of NHS leadership structures to help in failing trust emulate those that are promising, performing the best. Sajid Javid, the Health Secretary, has pledged that the review will be the most far-reaching of leadership in the NHS for 40 years and will level up regional disparities in care. Johnson is also expected to announce an extension of the right to buy to millions of people who rent from housing associations, as well as the extension of other home ownership schemes. There are also tentative plans to formally table the controversial legislation to override parts of the Northern Ireland Protocol. Polling over the weekend showed the Conservatives on course for a humiliating defeat in Wakefield. Several MPs from the 2019 general election intake have told colleagues they will not submit a letter until after that result. One MP said the Red Wall MPs who are wavering are looking only at Wakefield, adding, "Only then will the penny drop that he is not actually popular at all." When a confidence vote comes, Johnson's allies say it will be crucial for him to show he has the support of the majority of backbenchers. One MP said Theresa May lost the backbenchers, adding the Prime Minister has always got to get the payroll votes, those holding government posts, on side. But what he needs to do is get half the backbench at least, because then that gives a strong signal. One former minister, a supporter of Johnson, said that even among those who back him, he will need to win back trust and show he can win the next election, with a big agenda, adding he will survive, but obviously that will weaken him. If he soldiers on, then he's got an awful lot of work to do to make good the damage that has been sustained. But rebel MPs have circulated a private briefing document setting out a stark electoral picture about Johnson's prospects. It says, "The booing of Johnson at the Jubilee tells us nothing. The data does not, and that no social group polled says they trust the Prime Minister." Another point says the entire purpose of the government now appears to be the sustenance of Boris Johnson as Prime Minister, pointing to his personal negative ratings and saying that defending the indefensible is not to protect the party but one man. One minister said the residual loyalty to Johnson was now very thin, even among his supporters, adding, "Of course, the staff is going to catch up with him. He's toast. Everyone is tired of the drama. The only question is whether he manages to get through the election and to be able to get it a bit longer in number 10 before we get rid of him." Just 18 MPs have publicly declared that they have sent a letter. But MPs who are running the numbers believe there are at least 70 who have now publicly expressed a lack of faith in the Prime Minister. Most MPs seem resigned that the dam will break, but the timing is virtually impossible to guess given the lack of coordinated effort. One MP who opposes Johnson said, "It's all about individual MPs. There is not even any WhatsApp groups, as far as I know." Most MPs are prepared to challenge what is imminent. The MP said, "I'd say we were already there, and when Graham Brady, the chair of the backbench 1922 committee, who receives the letters, gets back to his office, there will be a load of more," adding, "I'd expect a vote on Wednesday, June 8th. The vote is a secret in-person ballot held in Parliament. To survive in office, a Tory leader requires the backing of a minimum of half of his MPs plus one, meaning Johnson would need the support of at least 180 of his parliamentary party." One MP said getting to 180 is a big ask, but it's a secret ballot. "I think a third of the payroll could go against him. If it's a third of them and two-thirds of backbenchers, suddenly you are in business," adding, "There will be a coordinated ring round by number 10, but I think that if we get to 180 or not, the number voting against will be a lot higher than the PM might think."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.